I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is a special edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We took the show to Moorestown, New Jersey on Tuesday night for a discussion about the state of our political system at Moorestown Community House. We asked John Runyon to join us. After serving for 4 years in the House representing New Jersey's 3rd District, he's not going back to Washington because of what he calls petty ambitions and misplaced priorities. Also with us is Ross Baker, Rutgers University professor, who spent last week in Senator Harry Reid's office watching the legislative process. His new book, Ask the Question, is Bipartisanship Dead? I began with John Runyon, who had played professional football with the NFL, most of those years with the Philadelphia Eagles.
To you, John Runyon, did 14 years of professional football in any way prepare you for Congress?
In some ways, but in many, I always say, people ask, what was the difference? I said, when I played football, the enemy had the other colored jersey on. In politics, you're taking friendly fire every day, so it kind of made it difficult to get your job done.
Was that a surprise to you, though?
On as large a scale as it happened, I believe so, yeah. You kind of expect it, you know, because it's a competitive world, and everybody's out to do what they do. But, you know, to the extent that you're obstructing people from actually governing, that's really my frustration, because it's the overriding, you know, aura of politics versus governing. You're sent there to govern. Politics is a necessary evil. I'll insert my first football analogy.
There you go.
Where everybody always loves going away to training camp and beating yourself up for a month is something you have to do to play the game. So the game is governing. The game was playing football. Training camp and politics are necessary evils to get to that end.
So you never felt like you actually played the game?
No. A lot of practice.
A lot of practice, but no game. Russ, does that sound like Washington to you?
Yeah, very much so. I think that we've gotten ourselves into a situation in which the legislative process, the process of making laws, has been kind of collapsed into the electoral process. And you kind of look at the last Congress and you kind of look at what Senator Reid was doing, for example. He was protecting vulnerable Democrats. Now, what that entailed for him was basically blocking Republicans from offering amendments that Democrats might be forced to vote on, embarrassing things, for example, things that would be politically damaging to them. So when you have that situation, and the retaliation for what Reid was doing, of course, was the filibuster.
Right.
So you get this kind of standoff, this kind of stalemate based on looking to the next election. I mean, already, for example, I got a list the other day when I was in Washington of the Republicans who are up for re-election in 2016. And along with it, the states, I guess, of the 24, I think 17 were in states that were won by Obama in either 2008 or 2012. And so this gave the Democrats a tremendous boost. And they thought, aha, we know we've got a whole bunch of vulnerable Republicans. And I would imagine that Mitch McConnell in the 114th Congress will be doing pretty much the same thing that Harry Reid was doing in the 113th.
People always say, well, the fix to this is term limits. I goes, well, we have term limits. They're called elections. And, you know, and people always talk about the approval rating of Congress, which is always below 10%.
I think it's 11 been. Or 12 now.
But they never talk about the next line in that poll, which is, do you approve of the job that your member is doing? And it's usually above 49%. And therein lies the problem. It's someone saying, it's not my guy, it's your guy. And that's the world we live in, and that's why all this stuff continues to snowball, because you're not really changing anything, because you're looking at the other guys. Truly educate yourself on what your person's doing, and does it represent your beliefs and the people around you's beliefs?
Well, is that because of gerrymandering? I mean, that everything is so gerrymandered that it makes it impossible for people to...
Well, that's a House problem, of course, because, you know, of course, the congressional districts in the states are subject to being to change every 10 years pursuant to a census. But that's not really the problem. The problem, I think, is the maldistribution of people in different parties across the country. Democrats, for example, are highly concentrated in cities and in close-in suburbs. Republicans are more evenly distributed throughout the country, and what that you come up with more districts that are favorable to Republicans. Now, you know, looked at from heaven, there would be a better way to do it, in which there would be more competitive districts, that those dense concentrations of Democrats would be spread out into areas where there are Republicans, would be more seats that would be 55, 45, and so on. But the way it is now, you add gerrymandering on top of that, and you get a situation in which you get a kind of a party lock on seats for years. And, you know, now I think, what is it, John, maybe 10% of seats are competitive? Out of 435 in the House, maybe 40, 45 seats, you know, could be won equally well by a Democrat or Republican, but that's a tiny number.
I can remember the first week of talking, and it was right when I got elected, the census was going on and redistricting was going to happen before the next election. And I can remember freshman orientation, Vice President Dick Cheney sitting in front of the whole class saying, as we continue to do this and create safer and safer seats, you continue to polarize the electorate, and you're going to end up with the same problem, and it's going to get more drastic as we continue to do this. We don't have state of New Jersey is a little bit different, being with a bipartisan commission on how we do it, but a lot of other states, it's done by the legislature. So it's different on everybody's state's constitution independently, but everybody still tries to push that envelope, getting those seats cut into a safe district.
Ross, is New Jersey, since we're in New Jersey, does New Jersey do it better than others?
New Jersey is unique in the United States.
Of course it is.
I've often thought that New Jersey politics ought to be bronzed and put it behind a glass case in the Smithsonian, because we have a kind of politics in the state that exists nowhere else. We have a strong county-level party organizations in the state, and some typically either Democratic or Republican. So you've got strong Democratic counties like Middlesex and Union, you've got strong Republican counties like Morris and Sussex and so on. But New Jersey politics, I think John would probably agree with you, isn't terribly ideological.
No. I had that conversation with Bob Menendez yesterday, actually. And then, you know, it's very bipartisan state. Everybody really gets along. Yeah. I think you know, Ross would agree, too. I mean, it's the only one that's really an outlier in the whole process is probably Scott Garrett.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody else is just kind of there to govern.
Right. I mean, I come back on the train from Washington on a Thursday night, and everybody's, you know, eating those miserable Amtrak sandwiches together, Democrats and Republicans.
Well, it's interesting you both say that, because one of the arguments in Washington is that the people in two-party, they don't know each other, they don't spend time together, maybe they don't like each other, but they're just, there's no socializing going on, and that's one of the reasons that there isn't legislating going on. Do you agree with that, John Runyon?
I mean, I wasn't there in the past when it was actually different, but I can see where that becomes an issue. I have some really good friends, close friends that are Democrats, but we're of the same mindset. You know, there are things, for example, I'll tell you, you know, former Congressman Andrews right next door to me here, I could talk anything in the world to him except health care. So I never went there. But we agreed on everything else pretty much, or we could get to where we could agree on it. It wasn't a problem. And I think part of it is people kind of put that wall up, and they don't want to talk about the things where they think they can work together and get things done, because it's going to take both parties to do it. Let's start the conversation and work on this, and you go get a couple of your buddies, I'll go get a couple of mine, and we'll make something happen. And that's, I don't know if there's people willing to put the effort in to do that.
Sounds so easy, Ross.
Yeah, I was one of the senators I interviewed for this book was Barbara Boxer from California, who is as liberal a Democrat as you're likely to find, and she is was in this last Congress the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources, it should be Energy and Public Works Committee, and her opposite number was James Inhofe from Oklahoma, who was as conservative as you can get, and I said, well, you know, how do you get anything done? And she said, well, she said, it's kind of like Venn diagrams. I know I can't go to talk to him about global warming because he thinks it's a hoax, but we both are interested in infrastructure. So basically, we agree on that. And some of the senators I talked to, I tried this out on. When I was speaking to Senator Leahy, I said, yeah, he said, you know, I don't get along with Grassley on much. He said, we agree on privacy issues. And what you have to do, you have to deal on that basis. They may not be the most pressing or the most important issues, but at least it establishes some kind of connection across party lines.
I've been fortunate enough to probably be on two of the most bipartisan committees in Congress, being Armed Services and Veterans Affairs. You know, those two, I mean, you develop great relationships across the aisle because you have a common purpose.
Let me ask you about money for Hurricane Sandy. I know this was maybe I'm not sure if this was a turning point for you or not, but the difficulty of trying to get money to help people in New Jersey recover from Sandy and what it took to try to get it through Congress and the frustration you felt from your own party, from the other party as well.
The biggest frustration about it was, and I've told the story many times, I had a lapel pocket card in my jacket for about 3-4 weeks going around. And it was a list of members on the Republican side of the aisle that had either requested FEMA assistance for or voted for it in their own state that were a no on the piece of legislation.
On a no for New Jersey?
Yes. And it was mind-numbing to me that they were going to be like that. And I called it my deadbeat list, you know?
Did they know that?
Oh, yeah. I was publicly came out in articles and said, well, I'm going around, you know, hunting up the deadbeats. The people that we need to really move this legislation forward. And then we got, obviously, to the point where we were about to vote on it, and Speaker Boehner pulls it off the floor without really any explanation. And now you're expecting me to go home for the weekend with no explanation, and you've kind of closed the door. And it was very, very frustrating. At the end of the day, was that the right move or not? We don't know, but it eventually got passed, and it took a while, and it was the frustrating part because I say this, and it's kind of like government is. As Katrina happened instantaneously, while waste, fraud, and abuse in that realm, and what government does, the overreaction to that crisis to now slam the door and move at a snail's pace. Hmm. You know, where's the happy medium in there, and how do we make this work?
Is that the sausage making of legislation, Ross?
Well, you know, it's a little
different.
Worse than that. It's, you know, it's sort of the abdominal surgery of politics, which is a lot more painful. And you know, one of the things that John mentioned is kind of interesting because so much of what does get done gets done in leadership offices at 11:30 at night before a recess or before an adjournment. And you know, we just passed a $1.1 trillion appropriations bill that most members didn't really have a chance to look at. And on a closer examination, people found a lot of things they really didn't like in that bill. And that's been the problem. And that is what John Boehner refers to as regular order. That is processing legislation in the way that you and I learned about it in our civics textbooks in high school. You know, bills are introduced, hearings are held, committee reports are issued, floor votes are taken, and everybody's included. Now you have basically a lot of the stuff it's done by, and not even the leadership, the elected leadership themselves, but staff basically are doing all of this. And they wield an enormous amount of influence. And they're very good at what they do, but, you know, it's not the way things ought to be done.
You're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. More after this short break. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. You're listening to an interview we recorded earlier this week when we took Radio Times on the road to Moorestown, New Jersey, for a conversation about our political system. Our guests are John Runyon, who served 4 years in the House representing New Jersey's 3rd District, and Ross Baker, political science professor at Rutgers University, author of Is Bipartisanship Dead? I put my next question to Ross Baker.
I mean, was there a good old days, Ross, when people got along and got legislation done and it was a happier place to be?
Well, you know, there are these people who believe there was a kind of golden age. And I think it was a peculiar time. There was a time in which the Democrats enjoyed sizable majorities in both houses of Congress. And this is particularly true of the House, that the Republicans saw no future for themselves. A friend of mine, a political scientist out at Claremont College, Jack Pitney, wrote a book back in 1992 called Republicans' Permanent Minority. Of course, 2 years later, the Republicans won the control of the House of Representatives. But you know, when you have a comfortable majority, all kinds of things can happen. For one thing, the opposition party realizes that they are outnumbered significantly. They can't cobble together enough opposition to the majority party, and they cut deals. They just decide to go along. Now, the intensity of campaigning is based upon the fact, in the Senate especially, that in any given two-year period, it could go from Democratic to Republican. As I mentioned, the Democrats looking forward to 2016 think, well, it's likely to go back from Republican to Democratic. Not so much the case in the House. You know, there might be a wave election in 2016 with the president up in which there's a big turnover in the House. But typically, the problem is that the margin of control is very close between the two parties, and this makes the combat much more intense.
Was there a certain issue? You served 4 years in the House. Was there an issue that you felt very passionate about that you wanted to take to Washington and at least get addressed, if not passed?
Not specifically. I mean, I truly went there, and I hate when people call me a politician because I'm the furthest thing away from it. I try to be, at least. You know, I prefer to be called a representative and taking the people's voice to Washington. You know, representing the very large veterans population we have here and the problems that they have within that bureaucracy. Obviously, this April, you know, that really blew up out there in Phoenix, and we're still dealing with that today. And it's a structural leadership problem with inside the agency itself, and really what their mission is, and you know, going down that path and finding your little niche. I mean, because obviously, I said I'm not a very political person, obviously, having no experience in policy. Am I going to influence policy that much? It's more about taking care and representing the people back home, and that's the view I took of it.
As you say, you don't like being called a politician, but do you think of yourself as a moderate Republican?
Yes, I do. You know, if you really throw labels on it, I call myself a common-sense conservative, you know, because it's really, what is the reality of what you can actually accomplish with the hand you're dealt? You know, if you want to go out and, you know, I think most people would, you know, that are want to be really conservative, I get that. You know, certain issues I'm exactly like that, and certain issues I'm not. But are you, if you're playing poker with somebody and you're not holding the right cards, are you really going to call them? You know, or are you just going to play the game a little bit and get what you can get done? And I think a lot of it comes from my team background. We all have a role in it. We're all good at our own little thing. Mm-hmm. But collectively, we're actually going to accomplish the mission.
To you, Ross, you spend a lot of time in Harry Reid's office, not just last week, but before. I think I've asked you this on the air before, but help us understand how he operates. And I will just admit that he's a mysterious figure to me.
Enigmatic
figure
good
to
word.
Me. I don't understand how he wields his power.
He's a remarkable guy. I once asked that question of someone who'd worked with him for a long time, and he told me two things. Number one is he's a great listener. That when Democratic senators, or actually any senator, has something to talk to him about, he'll listen. He will almost never dismiss something out of hand. His favorite expression is, "I'll take a look at it," which is kind of noncommittal, but it's not no. And the third thing is that he knows which buttons to push. So, you know, I once was asking him about the, you know, what qualities a majority leader should have, and I actually just finished a book in which one of the things that the author, a political scientist, had written was that a parliamentary leader should be eloquent. And Reid said, "Well," he said, "I'm not William Jennings Bryan," which is certainly true. I mean, he speaks basically in a whisper. But he's very smart, he's extremely tough, very shrewd, and knows parliamentary tactics. Mm-hmm. And I think you saw it on great display when he just pounced on Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz brought up a constitutional point of order on that on the appropriations bill, and it gave Reid an opening to get all these Obama nominees through. It's things like that make the Democrats elect him time after time.
And how did you or how do you see John Boehner as Speaker of the House?
I love what he does as, You know, you want to talk to someone about being a deal maker. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a Republican conference meeting, and Speaker Boehner will say, and he'll stand up in front of the whole conference, and no matter what the issue is, and you've all seen it happen many times, this is what will pass this chamber, this is what the Senate will pass, and the President will probably sign it. And then everybody blows up and say, well, it needs to be this. And then the Speaker will get back up and say, I hear what you're saying. He goes, it is the people's house, and I'm going to allow the people's voice to be heard. But I'm going to tell you, when the Senate takes this up and sends it back, it's going to be further to the left than what we sent them. And that's the dangerous game he's playing. But that's Speaker Boehner's internal belief that if that's the people's voice, then that's the people's voice. And he goes, I'm going to do what I can, but I'm going to tell you I told you so. And you know, obviously it comes from his experience and his knowledge of how the system is going to work. I think he's very good at it. I think, you know, the leverage he has sometimes, you know, it's, I don't know if he's playing all of his cards all the time, but he's just kind of letting people know. And, you know, time will tell if he's going to step up and do that type of stuff.
And how do you see Harry Reid? Do you think he'll be a minority leader?
He will.
He will be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a kind of relief for Democrats in a way to be?
Well, they say that there's nothing fundamentally more invigorating than throwing grenades rather than catching them. And so he has been catching grenades since 2007.
Yes, he has.
And now this is his chance to throw them. But, you know, that's an ominous sign. I mean, he's going to go to war over this. In terms of bipartisanship, that's not a good sign. I think that he certainly will use every resource at his disposal to, you know, make it tough for Mitch McConnell to get through whatever his agenda is, as Mitch McConnell did, you know, often proclaimed that his job basically was to stop the Obama agenda.
So is it all personal? Is this, I mean, is that what drives our political system?
It's not personal.
System?
I mean, that's the
it's
thing.
It's not.
No, it's not. I mean, Harry Reid once told me, this is kind of funny, I shouldn't be saying this, I suppose, but he said, when I'm in a room with Mitch and it's just the two of us, he said, I'm the chatterbox. So, I mean, you know, McConnell's even more taciturn than Reid, but they don't dislike each other. It's interesting. McConnell has the office that he has in the Capitol because Harry Reid got him that office. Harry Reid learned that McConnell had polio as a child and has a little bit of problem walking. So he got him a suite of offices as close to the floor of the Senate as he possibly could. It was a personal gesture on Reid's part. And these guys can deal. They can. They have the ability to do it, and when the circumstances arise, they can. McConnell showed it, I think, in the famous negotiations with Joe Biden in 2012, the so-called fiscal cliff.
Right.
And the reason why Biden was there rather than the president was because these people knew each other. Biden and McConnell had served together for a long time. And that's one of the things the president lacks, is that kind of connection to people on the Hill. And I think, you know, some of the complaints, I think, are not well-founded. But I think in that particular instance, I think it would have been better if he had more people that he actually knew in Congress.
I wanted to ask about the president, and how do you see him, John Runyon?
I think one of the biggest things is, obviously, as Ross said, not having those relationships. So it's very, very political for him. You can be as political as you want, but it goes back to the statement I just had in the last question. It's like, you have to play the cards you're dealt, and are you truly governing to the best of your ability with that hand? And that I think most people agree the president's not doing a very good job of that, just from a leadership standpoint. You know, I use the Ronald Reagan example all the time. He was much more conservative a person as any piece of legislation he ever signed, but he realized what he had to do to govern and get that done. And you say that to conservatives because they're always attacking me, calling me a rhino and that kind of thing. You know, it's the hand we're dealt, and we're sent there to do a job, and that's the reality of where we're at.
But for you, Ross, I mean, it's interesting, and some people have compared Obama and Reagan, and in certain ways how Reagan was able to get, in fact, many things that Reagan passed would never have gotten through Congress today.
immigration being one.
That's true, but I can't imagine two more different personalities than Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama. President Obama is an introvert, and which is an unusual quality for a politician. He's diabolically smart, but he's not someone who feels very much at ease. I was talking to Ken Walsh, who was the White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and he recalled going in to see George W. Bush, and Bush knew the names of his kids and complimented him on his necktie, where with President Obama, he goes in there and Obama says, "All right, what's your first question?"
Hmm.
So, you know, very different kind of personality. And then there is an argument, I think, to be made. President was elected to the Senate in 2004, sworn in 2005, and became president in 2008. So he had basically 3 years of experience in the Senate. You know, that's a little light in terms of experience. So he's had to do a lot of on-the-job learning, which I think, you know, complicates things for him. And, you know, that together with what we were talking about in terms of the lack of long-term associations on the Hill, I think hurt him as well.
But as you said, Mitch McConnell, I mean, very publicly known now, I mean, the determination to basically thwart whatever the president tried to do.
Is that just
politics? Is it just the way the game is played?
I think that McConnell was probably unusually blunt. Perhaps, I think, had he thought about it a little bit more, he might have phrased it a little more felicitously. But, I mean, that he saw that as his job. And you know, he knew what was coming. And he knew that much of what the president was going to send up he was not going to like. So, in a sense, I suppose you got to give him credit for candor.
Yeah. I'm curious about what advice you would have. I, in fact, interviewed some new members of Congress. They're going in down to Washington in January and full of ideas and things that they want to change. What advice do you have for the newbies coming to Washington?
As we all are, and I actually did a show earlier this afternoon with my successor, Tom MacArthur, and I said, thank God you're bald because you'll be pulling your hair out in the first 6 months.
Truly?
You know, but... Truly, and I think he's kind of learned the process a little bit as going through the steering committee and getting his committee assignment kind of set up. It's like you got to know what person, and Ross has said this, in leadership to go to really get to the root of it, and what do I have to do to get this process moving forward? And that, you know, and maybe in leadership and maybe the chairman of the right committee. You know, you got to find who that person is, and you're not going to, you're not truly going to be able to do it by yourself because you're going to have to build a coalition. And the best way to do that is either through the Speaker's office or the Leader's office. And you might have to find a staffer in that office that's going to shepherd it for you.
Hmm.
And that's the reality of the world that is.
I mean, an intense kind of hierarchy, I guess,
yes.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. No, I think John's making an interesting argument for lobbyists.
Did you mean to do that?
I would say this. I mean, whether it's a member lobbying a member lobbying a senior staffer, you lobbying me on your favorite charity. At the end of the day, we're all asking for something, so that's kind of the definition of a lobbyist, is it not?
Is it not?
Yeah, and you know, I think my point would have been that the reason people hire lobbyists is they don't know who to talk to on the Hill. And if you're a business person with a problem, and let's say you were in IT or something like that, you don't necessarily know that it's the Energy and Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over the problem that you have. So you go to a lobbyist who says, okay, you want to talk to so-and-so on the Energy and Commerce Committee. And I think what John was saying was that basically you have to sort of, when you come in, you want to get on the right committee. I'm sure that Congressman MacArthur, you know, would not want to be on a committee that has no connection at all to the 3rd Congressional District.
Right.
I mean, you'd want to, you know, he might want to be on Armed Services rather than Agriculture. I mean, I can't see him going on Agriculture.
He is on Armed Services.
Great.
But at the same time, and I'm thinking, I think we all heard Elizabeth Warren complaining bitterly about this budget bill, $1.1 trillion, and in that, a provision that she thought really undid a piece of Dodd-Frank. And her complaint was that Citigroup had basically helped to write that piece of the legislation and her outrage over that.
Yeah, well, it's not uncommon.
Right.
I think you have interested parties who are very, very deeply involved in the process of writing legislation. I think on the Democratic side, you've got people from environmental groups, labor unions, and so on, who basically are sitting down with staff and saying, we think it should read this way. We live in a society in which, in a political system, which interest groups are terribly important. There are probably too many of them. They're probably often too loud and too demanding and so on. But it's what James Madison said that was going to happen in a free society.
But interest groups with checkbooks. I mean, there's a difference between being an interest group and one that's giving money to a campaign.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting. A lot of interest groups don't have checkbooks that are that big. What they do have are voters. You know, for example, if a large corporation is located in a congressional district, the representative of that company is going to have a pretty loud voice in that congressional office because there are a lot of people whose well-being and welfare is dependent on the success of that business.
You agree with that, John Runyon?
I put it this way. I mean, most of the people that, 99% of the people that have ever contributed to my campaign, we had something in common way before they ever wrote the check, whether it's a corporation or someone at that corporation. Obviously, because we had that in common, they're going to sit down to talk to me about their specific niche issues in their industry that we want to work on. Okay, so if it's that niche, what member of Congress that has, obviously, if it's in banking, how many people have really had a career in banking that are members of Congress? So how are you going to know how to solve it and how to word it, you know, and get it to do what you want to do? And by the way, when you get that, you turn it over to Ledge Counsel, and it comes out saying something different. That's the reality. I've done it several times, trying to work with Ledge Counsel to say, this is what I want this to do. And then the lawyers get a hold of it, and it comes back, and it's like, no, that's not even close. Let's try it again. And it becomes a process. And I tell you, about half the time, you just throw your hands up and say, I can't do this anymore. And that again is another frustration.
You're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We'll be back after this very short break. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. You're listening to a conversation recorded earlier this week in Morristown, New Jersey, about the state of our political system with our guests Ross Baker from Rutgers University and John Runyon, who represented New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives for 4 years. So what are you going to miss? I mean, it's clear you're going to miss something about this job you had for 4 years.
I think like anything else, there's a lot of good people there that you've become close friends with. To quote Mike Rogers, who's retiring from Michigan, I'll miss the clowns, but I won't miss the circus. it's really, there's good people there that are there to do the right thing. And I always say it's, and I equate everything from an electorate to what makes the evening news to the bell-shaped curve. The only thing you're going to hear is the stuff on the tails. You're never going to hear about the stuff in the middle that actually get things done. And that's the unfortunate world we live in.
And it's interesting because one of the things that characterized the last few days in Congress has been the loud voices of both the right and the left on this $1.1 trillion appropriations bill that Elizabeth Warren on the left doesn't like the fact that there's this so-called push-out provision that's been removed from, you know, it's kind of esoteric, but it's gotten a lot of people all fired up. On the other hand, Ted Cruz thinks the appropriations bill should be a vehicle for going after the president on what he did on immigration.
I've always said, I goes, if I have people on both sides of the aisle upset with the way I voted, I must be doing the right thing at the end of the day. And there's a lot of truth to that.
But there are people that think compromise is really surrender.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. No,
and if you really believe something,
right? Yeah,
why would you compromise?
Yeah, I mean, one of the points I make in the book is that not everything that's bipartisan is good. I mean, there's some atrocious bipartisan legislation that's passed. I mean, pick a piece of legislation that you just hate. You know, whether it's No Child Left Behind or the Iraq War vote, they were all bipartisan. So, you know, and I think that sometimes people use bipartisanship as kind of a cover, whereas, I mean, sometimes I think there's legislation that's passed with a one-party vote that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. You even say, you know, if something can be called bipartisan, if it's 275 votes on one side and 4 votes on the other, and that's called bipartisan.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and one of the interesting things is Obamacare was bipartisan, that in the process of going through the Finance Committee in the Senate, Ways and Means in the House, and so on, a lot of Republicans had input into that. One of the reasons why there is no public option was to pick up Republican votes. Olympia Snowe, senator from Maine, was very important in the early stages of Obamacare and helped shape that legislation. And although at the end there were no Republican votes for it, it had Republican DNA.
In fact, you say in your book, which is, as I said, a question, is bipartisanship dead? You said really in the committees, that's where you see bipartisanship at work. Maybe once it gets out beyond the committees, right, not so much.
That's right. Well, John was saying that armed services, both in the House and the Senate, are bipartisan committees. These are generally people who have large military facilities in their district or aerospace or something like that. So they have something in common. They are responsible for authorizing the legislation which keeps the Pentagon in business. They have, so you know, there's a lot that they can agree on.
And then you go through the process of actually taking that piece of legislation, very bipartisan. And I think our NDAA this last year passed unanimously through the House committee, and then you get to the floor and open it up for amendments. And this is where it starts to go in everybody else's direction. And then the final result, then half the people bail off of it. And then you get something that, you know, the people that, pay the attention to detail day in and day out on this kind of stuff, it turns into a different piece of legislation, mm-hmm, and people fall off of both ends all the time.
Those are called sweeteners, are they not? Sweeteners?
Right. Yeah. They're put in there. I mean, the sweeteners aren't as bountiful as they used to be since earmarks were eliminated. But there's still ways to get things to people that you want to get them. You want certain things to get through. You write legislation in such a way that, although you don't name the company, the way you write it could apply to only one company in the United States.
I will remind most people, and a lot of people miss this point a lot of time. Once that bill comes out of committee, it is 10 times harder to actually change that piece of legislation and get it to say what it wants to. If you're in the committee process before that committee gets, i.e. the appropriations bill, out, it's a lot easier to go that process. So if you're actually doing your homework and, you know, talking to the right people, talking to the subcommittee chairman before he marks up his bill and hands it over to the full committee chairman, it's even easier. So if you're part of the process from early on, it works a lot better and a lot more efficiently.
So, Ross, what do you expect with Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate in 2015 moving forward? And, I mean, do you expect anything different from what we've observed in the last 2 years?
Well, you know, I think some things are going to be the same. There's something in the House known as the Hastert Rule. And it was something that named after the former Speaker Dennis Hastert. Speaker Boehner uses it too. And he knows, for example, that when a bill comes out of the House, he wants to make it as much a Republican / conservative bill as possible, because he knows what's going to happen to it when it goes over into the Senate. Even with the Senate in Republican hands, that effect will be the same. That instead of Republicans filibustering something, it'll be Democrats filibustering something. So the way you structure the legislation in the House always has to take account of the fact the Senate is a very different place. And, you know, I think in a very strange way, I think that the advent of the Tea Party, this may sound paradoxical, is actually going to help bipartisanship, because John Boehner is going to need Democratic votes. So on, you know, things that he cares about, he's going to have to talk to his good friend Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi. Yeah.
Interesting. Are you going to miss asking for money?
No.
And how often did you have to do that?
Oh, that's, frankly, that's more than half of your life. I tell
and
you.
And how do you do that? Well, what is the pitch?
When you're in Washington, you're basically begging. You're begging people. And it's, when you're in Washington, it's coffee with three people for breakfast, you're having lunch with probably four or five, and you're having dinner with four or five more people.
You making come, the pitch, you know, every time.
And you're coming home, you know, you have a block time, call time in the afternoon, and even down there you have it. You're literally picking up the phone and calling lists. And I can't tell you how many people I've called that are no longer with us. And you talk about being, you know, embarrassed, and it's like, oh, I'm sorry for your loss, and it's like,
oh, really? Calling people who were dead?
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
all the monthly, at least two a month, and it gets into that, and it's you know, and going around and trying to organize fundraisers. I was always the type of person, like, I hate cold calling people. Let's try to
believe me, people hate getting those calls,
you know,
too.
And I always try to say, you know, get my fundraising staff to put together 4 or 5 events over the next 6 months of all different tastes, whether it's, you know, at a vineyard, or, you know, we're doing an Eagles watching or something everyone kind of wants to mix politics and some fun with, and have that list and say, I've got 6 events coming up in the next 5-6 months. Can you make one of them make contribution? And it's actually really hard to do that. Yeah. I mean, you're going to get your regulars, but how do you pull the next guy into the fold?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, because your normal people is like, yeah, I'm gonna donate to you, but you won't see me. You know, that kind of thing. And it's trying to pull in the next guy. And a lot of it is too, you know, can you spare, you know, $20 to help? I mean, is it, you know, you're calling people you've never spoke to before. It's like, what are you interested in? And some people will go off on the 35-40 minute rant, and you're like,
I gotta call somebody.
Right. You know, I only got an hour left, and there's 75 people on this list.
We're talking about campaigns that are millions and millions and millions of dollars.
That's right. I was reading today about a campaign up in Hudson Valley of New York, which I think in the aggregate, I think almost $4 million was spent. And these are house districts, for goodness sake. It's not the whole state of New York. And, you know, depending on things like the media market. I mean, if you feel you need to advertise on New York or Philadelphia television, you're in a completely different ballgame. And you don't think of members of Congress being like telemarketers, but in some ways they are.
When I say it's half your life, it literally is. Every spare moment you have in Washington is doing it, and you're coming home. Now, like we were talking earlier, I'm the type of person, I want to go out and touch as many people as I can physically to make that connection. Ultimately, you're spending the money to get someone's vote. So are you spending the money fundraising, or are you spending the money making a personal connection, or spending the time, which everybody knows time is money, you know, acquiring that vote? And I think some people are more comfortable just sitting in their office, closing the door, and having that technology disconnect. And then, unfortunately, that's the society we live in nowadays, but that's just not how I like to operate, and I hated being on the phone.
Yes, sir. Right up front here.
To the panel, thank you. Really interesting discussion. Question, why don't we have a viable third party nationally, and when will we?
And that's a question that haunts politics, about a viable third party.
Well, we've tried it, and we were successful in 1912 in getting a party that got several million votes. But, you know, since then, it really hasn't been very popular. And it's interesting because it's a little bit like hamburgers. That McDonald's, you know what a Big Mac is. And with Burger King, you know what a Whopper is. So, you know, there are Burger King people and there are Whopper people. There are Pepsi people and there are Coke people. A lot of things are kind of binary like that. Same thing with political parties. And the fact is that at least until recently, there was enough choice in both political parties. If you were a conservative Democrat, you could feel comfortable in the Democratic Party. If you were a liberal Republican, there was room for you there. The problem is the sorting out process has meant that you have to make a very stark choice if you're going to choose between political parties. And the efforts, for example, by people like Mayor Bloomberg to, you know, the no labels movement and so on, really hasn't gotten anywhere.
Yeah. And why? Well, I'm sure. That's true. Yeah. Why do you think? What do you think?
It goes to a lot what Ross is saying to really get there. And by all means, I mean, I'm not going to talk about what my platform is here. I have some liberal views myself. I've came out and said them publicly. But where, you know, you have two choices. You have McDonald's and Burger King. What side are you going to fall on? Now it goes back to campaign help. And what party is going to help you the most try to get elected? That's where we're at. I mean, it's possible there, but are there enough issues that everybody's like straight down the middle to start that other party? I think that's the bigger question.
Yes, sir. Question up front here.
Yes. This has to do with a historical perspective. The country has gone through great changes in terms of bipartisanship over the years. An example is Andrew Jackson. His predecessor, president, wouldn't even go to his inauguration. and he was very polarizing. Combine that with the fact that our country is changing and becoming more and more urbanized and more Hispanic than it used to be. I'm an old white man, and us old white men are going to probably contribute much less to the electorate as we all die off.
There will always be more old white men coming along, I guarantee it.
At least for a while.
But not as many as a percentage.
Probably not, no.
So the question is, how long is this dead bipartisanship going to last? What will change it so that we become bipartisan again? Because that's the way the country has gone over the years.
Mm. Well, what do you think, Ross?
I know some very respectable people in my profession who argue that bipartisanship is an anomaly in American politics. That if you look back to the 19th century, certainly the period before the Civil War was a period of great partisan rancor and hostility, of, you know, people getting caned in the House of Representatives, and things were very polarized. And even after the Civil War, the same thing was true. And so actually a period of bipartisanship, which lasted roughly, let's say, from the late 1950s to the maybe late 1960s, a very, very brief period in American history. And I think back, you know, to the 1950s, the McCarthy period. Does anybody think that was bipartisan? Certainly not. We were certainly polarized over the Vietnam War. But I think that because partisan balance in Congress, with one dominant party in Congress, you had a much greater incentive for the minority party to cooperate. Now, because the numbers are so close, the combat has become much more intense and much fiercer.
Mm. Yes, sir. Question in the back.
Yeah, I'm an old white guy that wants to preserve Social Security and Medicare. Thank you very much. $44 million at least was spent on these midterm elections. There are now going to be in 2016 the national conventions for both Republicans and Democrats, and very likely in swing states. Is there a correlation between money spent and candidates being elected or issues being favorable to those high spending amounts?
What do you think, John Runyon?
There's an obvious correlation, because if you can saturate the market with your issue, whether it's fact, opinion, or something pulled out of thin air, and people hear it enough, you know, it's self-fulfilling prophecy. If you tell yourself it enough, it's probably the truth, whether it is the truth or not. So if it's drilled into your head constantly that that candidate thinks that way, then eventually people are going to go, well, maybe he is that crazy. You know, there's no way I'm going to vote for him. And that's the reality of human nature. And that's really what you're getting at. I mean, political campaigns, the number one thing they tell you, find something to pull on the heartstrings. Draw on the emotion. Because emotion, whether it's jubilation or fear, change people's minds. And I hear it all the time. People go, I hate negative campaign ads. I will not vote for anybody that does it. Do you know what moves elections? Negative campaign ads. Because it draws on emotion. And at the end of the day, that's what they're spending the money to do, is get in there and get your heart to follow that candidate.
Well, my thanks to both you, John Runyon, and you, Ross Baker, for joining us this special evening event here. Thanks so much. That's John Runyon and Ross Baker speaking earlier this week at Morristown Community House in New Jersey before an audience of WHYY supporters. The engineers for the event were Charlie Kyer and Adam Staniszewski. Support for Radio Times on the Road from Art Ellis and Brittany Smith. This interview was produced and edited by John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay with us for Hour 2.